I would just say there's one misperception of our veterans, and that is they are somehow damaged goods. Although if we tell our veterans enough that this is what's wrong with them, they may actually start believing it.
Hey, this is Tommy from Recon Rings, and you're listening to Dead Reckoning Radio. Use code DEADRECKONING to save 10% off any purchase at reconrings.com. Recon Rings, for those that live kinetic lives.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Dead Reckoning Radio. This is episode 19 with Michael Ramos. Michael Ramos is a veteran that joined the Navy 13 days before 9/11, and he's proud to claim that he's just a regular dude that fulfilled his role honorably. After his time in service, his passion for reading and writing matured into a master's degree in creative writing. He became a professor for UNC Wilmington, and that's what we focus on during the podcast. He developed a course called Reading and Writing the War, where he teaches both civilians and veterans how to shape their stories and make art of war. Michael's a passionate dude in regards to reading and writing. You hear it in his voice throughout the podcast. We love talking to him. I know he pumped me up. We hope you enjoy.
Hey, Michael, how's it going, man?
It's going pretty well. How are you guys doing?
Good, good.
Doing good, man.
It's good to have you on. This is probably the quickest we've put one together, and I think that kind of shows how excited we are about that course that you're teaching. So we're definitely going to get into that in the show, but we'll just open up the floor to you now to kind of talk about where you come from and how you grew up, and then get into the military stuff.
Yeah, sure, man. Thanks for having me. My kid, he's on pump right now, and he's pretty stoked, so he's waiting for this to come out, too. So
nice.
And I'm glad you guys are really excited about the course. I am, too. I've been waiting for it for a long time. A little bit about myself. I was a Greenside RP for about 9 years, 10 months, and 28 days, but, you know, who's counting? For those of you folks that are not Marine or Navy folks, I was basically just a chaplain's assistant, but I was assigned to the Marines. And my first unit was at First Combat Engineers, and then I moved into various units around First Marine Division. We invaded Iraq. That was kind of cool because there was like zero ROE. I mean, there was like three. obviously, I'm being as hyperbole. I mean, if you go look at the CIFLIC rules, like there were plenty. But you know, generally, it was like it was interesting. Let's say that. And then
no doubt.
Then I ended up promoting myself out of a job. So I
while you were downrange,
I came back and then I got promoted. I got hurt actually. Well, I was not like wounded hurt, like I was stupid and I fell off a mountain while running. and I didn't want to go to medical because I was still a boot. And you know, when you're in a training command and you get hurt, what happens? Well, you go home, and I didn't want to go home. So I just sucked it up and kept training on it and kept training on it and kept training on it. And finally, wearing all the gear. It just got to where my hips couldn't handle it. So I was getting lidocaine shots every couple days in country. So when I got back, my MO was like, yeah, your ass is going on limited duty. And I got promoted a couple times. And then came back to the fleet, deployed with 2-4. Ended up going to Okinawa with them. We thought we were going to go to Iraq. You know, it's a really weird thing, the whole idea of like, you hate it, but then you want to go back. And that's part of where this course is coming from. So then I went to Okinawa, you know, did the 30 worst mute, which was awful. It wasn't so bad, but it wasn't the deployment that I wanted. And then I got promoted to division staff. So I worked for a bunch of the commanding generals and then went to the Naval Academy. And then I was like, yeah, I'm going to go do something else.
Wow. Oh, so you didn't even finish the academy?
No, well, I mean, I wasn't going to the academy. I joined late. I was the old man in the platoon. I was like 25 when I, and I joined 13 days before 9/11.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's really funny. Like I actually wrote about it in the manuscript that I've got, or maybe I deleted it anyway. I come off the bus from MEPS cause I was in California and, our MEPS was in San Diego and my wife at the time, she's now my ex, was in tears. I'm like, I don't worry about it. You know, it's not like we're going to get in a worldwide conflict or anything. Then at 6 o'clock in the morning or whatever the exact time was, 13 days later, I come in to watch the second plane hit the tower. And so I tried to get out of my contract with the Navy and go into the Marines as an infantryman, because I was like, well, they're going to need infantrymen now, so let me go do that. And they're like, yeah, nah, you want to go to war. I'm like, well, yeah. Mm-hmm. They're like, yeah, we're going to hold on to your contract, so it sucks to be you, bro. So that's how that went. I volunteered to go with the Marines the first chance I could get, stayed there for most of my career, got sent to the Naval Academy to run their chaplain's office. And that was a whole dog and pony show. I mean, the flagpole was literally a baseball throw away. Mm-hmm. Always had dignitaries working 6-7 days a week. I mean, it was shore duty, but it was not shore duty. And I wanted to go back to deploying, and they wanted me to stay on a carrier. The Navy, big Navy did. And I was like, not having any of it. So I was like, oh, well, let me go get a degree and come back in as an officer. And then right about that time, and I had chosen UNC Wilmington because all of my friends, they were corporals and I was a third class petty officer and sergeants and I was second class. We were all out in California together, so we were coming up in the ranks. Well, they had made the migration to North Carolina. I was like, well, let me go to UNC Wilmington. It's pretty close by. The woman who is now my wife that I was dating at the time, she lived there, so it just made sense. I applied for a commission, like, hey, look, you're old, you're broken, and the war's going to end. Don't tell nobody that because, you know, nobody knows, but the war's ending. We're not going to need you. Have a nice life. Like, all right, cool. I don't know what else to do with my life, but sure, fine, whatever. and right about that time, I had gotten my first publication. My first it was called Boxes. And it was all the it was a prompt on the Sun Literary Magazine, and it's a nonfiction piece. And it was basically looking at my military career through all the boxes I'd had come into contact with. So like the 7Cube, the Quadcon, the Palcon, mailboxes, and of course coffins. And I talk about how my son sent me boxes, and maybe one day I'll send him boxes. Well, as it turns out, I just sent him a couple boxes because he's on float now. And that was one of the things that's really, so that was in 2010. That's really probably where I started getting a desire to make art out of war stories and looking at our life through different lenses that people outside of our life can actually gravitate to and would at least be willing to engage with. And so that's how that came about. So I finished my undergraduate degree. I finished my graduate degree at UNC Wilmington, and now I'm a temporary faculty member there.
What were your degrees in?
Both my degrees are in creative writing. So my undergraduate degree is in creative writing, and then my master's of fine arts is in creative writing as well. The funny thing is, I wanted to major in history and foreign languages because I thought I was going to be an officer. And the texts were so bad. Like, some of the books that we were reading were so bad, and they were so old, and they were so dry. And I was like, I can't do this.
No, there's no way.
And yeah. And I used to write a lot as a kid. By write, I mean, I used to scribble all my teenage angst in like cheap notebooks or whatever. Thankfully I've lost them, and they can burn in the pits of hell for all I care. I don't ever want to see them, but it was good practice, you know? My mom always made sure we had books. You know, grow up a poor working class kid. My dad worked in the oil fields and water treatment companies around the state of California. But we always had books, and we always read, and naturally that led to writing. And so one of the first things I did was like, well, I'd always written as a kid.
Who did you like reading when you were younger?
I think one of my – I loved Agatha Christie. I loved murder mysteries.
Really?
Hercule Poirot was my favorite character of all. I didn't really care for Miss Marple or the other characters that she'd written. Rudyard Kipling was one of my favorites as well.
Yeah.
Captain's Courageous. In fact, I still have it on my bookshelf today. I think maybe last year we had our orientation for our incoming graduate students. And one of my colleagues, Melissa Crow, who's a wonderful poet, was like, asked us who do we imagine ourselves as a literary character, and who do we fear we are as a literary character. I'm like, I imagine myself, or I wish I was Harvey Janey, you know, being born into money. You go get a working class education, get knocked on your ass, you come to your senses, and then at the end there's the money waiting for you. So I was like, I'm still waiting for that. And of course my fear was that I'm Walt Kowalski from Gran Torino. So, you know,
I
spend a good deal of time telling kids to get off my lawn these days, but yeah, whatever.
Man, it is, I know.
It's weird. I used to laugh at all the do not walk on grass signs, and now I'm like, get off my grass.
Man, you got to work hard for that.
Yeah, you do.
I got to retail and regrade my whole entire yard, and I've realized that's an extra thing. So trust me, I can relate.
Yeah, and then you're like, this is mine. I got some pride in that.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Wear the New Balances and turn those suckers green eventually.
Yeah. I used to read a lot of, I read Around the World in 80 Days when I was a kid, too. I really like that. Mark Twain, I grew up reading the classics, which was great in some ways. And in other ways, it made me a snob when I came to college. I went to college at 34. We had money to send me to college. I had gotten into plenty of colleges as a kid. We didn't have the money to send me, actually, is what I meant to say. Okay. So I had to go to work. You know, worked at a bunch of various jobs, but I still read. And so when I come, I get out at 34, which, by the way, I got out on Monday, drove down from Annapolis to Jacksonville, which is where I lived at first. On that Monday, I think I started school on Tuesday. I wouldn't recommend that.
Yep.
I should have definitely taken a break, but you know. Hindsight's 2020. What are you gonna do?
Indeed.
Yeah. No. I kind of did the same thing with the Fire Academy. It's like maybe a week between, and then another buddy got out like a month or so after me, and he went and hiked the Appalachian Trail for like 6 months. And I'm like, yeah, I should have probably done that because I don't think I'll ever have the opportunity until I retire.
Yeah. Like, you know, it's all that stuff you don't think about until after. It's like, oh, thanks. But yeah. So like that really. So I have all that. All read all the classics, and then I came to get my undergraduate degree. And people are reading all this stuff. I'm like, I don't know what this is, and I'm not sure I appreciate a lot of this. but you know, I've branched out, and now I've leveled out. That's one of the things. That's one of the other reasons. There's a lot of reasons why I'm excited about this course, and that's one of them too. Is I get to be and give to veteran writers and veteran students what I didn't have.
Yeah.
A lot of veterans get out and they go to school and like these kids are quoting this writer and this writer and this writer and this book. And like, and I went through the same thing. It's like, I remembered every General Mattis quote I ever heard him tell me. I mean, I worked with him. Like we had conversations. I remember everything, like all the cool moto quotes from Chesty Puller and all those guys. But like, you know, W.H. Auden said about something, I have no idea.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating and it causes a lot of stress. Not that stress can't be overcome, but like, you know, you get out thinking like, oh, I'm an American. I live in America. It'll be just like coming home. And it's not, it's more like being Rip Van Winkle.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you also probably spent a considerable amount of time away, like more than we did because of, you know, being like in a Mew and stuff like that, where you're, you know, you're at sea and all that.
Yeah. And that was fun and that was cool. And, but yeah, you know, you get out, you're gone to wherever the edge of empire is what I tell people. And then you come back and it's like, oh, okay. Somebody put the pause button on and didn't bother to tell me.
So within that, like when you come back and, you said that you didn't really appreciate the writing initially. What kind of transitioned you into actually appreciating kind of academia, like prescribed reading? And then what kind of reading do you do now different than when you were a kid?
Well, I still read a lot of the classics now that I'm a lecturer. I mean, I have to. But I read a lot more modern poetry. Like one of the... Graham Barnhart's The War Makes Everyone Lonely, like that comes out in September. That's a modern poet. I mean, it just so happens he's a vet, but my colleague Melissa Crow, her book, Dear Terror, Dear Splendor, a lot of the stuff that's in the literary circles that people in my peer group are reading, I'm reading those things too. Some of it I'm reading for craft, looking like how did this writer solve a problem that I'm running into, and some of it I'm reading for enjoyment. I read a lot of Ross Gay's poetry. I think it's really good. And then with my, it's funny, but I'm a nonfiction writer by trade, but I actually don't read a lot of nonfiction. I usually read more poetry and fiction, which shows up in writing, of course.
I've actually gone the same way.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because I teach a forms class every once in a while at UNC Wilmington. Actually, I've taught it quite a bit. And one of the things that we look about is I go all the way back to Homer, which I'm not doing in this course. But in that course, I go all the way back to Homer and even a little bit after him, Aristotle. He broke down all of the writing disciplines, right? There's poetry and there's history. But nonfiction, some of it was history in his mind, but some of the nonfiction counted as poetry, looking at the Iliad and the Odyssey. For him, those were facts, but he considered those poetry. So now in modern era, people are like, oh, well, this is just so weird because poetry and nonfiction are fused. It's like, well, actually, if you look historically at where we've come from, it's not all that weird. I dork out about all this writing stuff, which is why I'm glad I have a degree. it gives me that freedom. The last thing I read, though, was Ron Chernow's biography of Grant, which I thought was fascinating. Grant and Roosevelt are two of my favorite presidents. Grant was interesting. They never go so far as to say that Grant struggled with PTSD or separation anxiety, but it's obvious. Like, after he went to the Mexican-American War, he came home to a civilian career and just couldn't plug in. He didn't care about running a store, and he didn't care about banking. He was a tactician.
I was just listening to something not too long ago, and I can't remember the author's name, but he wrote 1,000 books to read before you die, and the subject of memoirs or not autobiographies came up, and he could not stress the importance of Ulysses S. Grant's anything written about him, because how interesting he was, and just.
Yeah,
his story, and then his writings themselves were so good.
Yeah. My wife, who was the woman I was dating when I got out and moved down here, she bought me Ulysses S. Grant's actual memoirs, and it's like a Penguin classic. And then I've got the other biography. So seeing them together is really interesting. The biography by Ron Chernow is great because it talks about. Did Grant have an alcohol problem? He probably did, but he had it under control. Or was he just medicating?
Yeah.
I mean, and they never made that link to self-medication, but, you know, those of us that have lived the life, we'd be able to recognize it that quick. We're like, I know exactly what he's doing. So that's what I've been reading lately. And then, of course, I've been reading through my reading list for the class. I have the luxury of having read some of those books, and some of them I'm rereading, and some of them are first reads for me. So,
yeah. So let's get right into the class. Called Reading and Writing the War.
Yeah, I wish I would have come up with like a cooler title, but that's basically what I've got.
That leads me to my next question: was this your baby? Like, is this your brainchild? Like, was there motivation from the university to get it going, and you were kind of just the guy who jumped on it first, or what happened?
A little bit of all of that, yes.
Okay.
I'll try to unravel this as easily as I can in the space allotted. Okay, so this has pretty much always been the thing I've wanted to do. Is it my baby? No. I'm sure there are, if you go to colleges all across the country and universities, I'm sure that there is a civilian or a veteran instructor that this is really important to them, and they have some version of this course. I didn't do my homework and see who else had done this. I had a student of mine he was a Marine. He got out. His name was Ryan, and he went up to Suffolk University, and he's like, oh man, he's like, this university has this course where we're reading a bunch of war writing. And I'm like, oh man, I wish I could teach that course. So I've always wanted to teach that course ever since I decided, when the Marine Corps officer recruiter told me I was old and broken and there was no way I was coming back, I'd always kind of really wanted to make that leap and start bridging the gap between military and civilians. Mostly, I'll be honest, it was at the time selfish. Like, for me, like, I hadn't figured out how to bridge that gap, and I figured I'd just drag all these people with me while I was trying to figure this out. And I still haven't figured it out, but, you know, I've made some headway. And I just went to my department chair and I was like, look, David. David Gessner's a great guy. His book on he's got a book on Teddy Roosevelt coming out, which I can't wait to read. He's an outdoorsy guy, loves the West, loves Edward Abbey, and the anarchy, the anarchist environmentalist, I guess. Like, he's like down with the establishment and does take care of the environment.
Hell yeah.
And we've had and he's a good dude. Him and I get along really well, and we talk a lot about stuff, like about books and how veterans have, there's this call usually for veterans to go back out and out into the land, and either they go into agriculture, or they go into the National Park Service, or like there's this weird pull, or even if they don't, they, for whatever reason, like we didn't get enough camping and that life, like they have this call to go back out to the outdoors. Like, it's a reason.
Yeah.
So we talked a lot about this, and I was like, you know, we have a lot of veterans coming through this program in the undergraduate program. Let me teach this class. And he's like, okay. And I thought I was going to have to like, lobby and everything. And I was like, oh, well, okay.
That easy.
So that was how that worked.
Pop, no kick.
You know, and it was great. Yeah. And it was great because he gave me the latitude to plan the course as I saw fit.
Hmm. Nice.
He's like, and so for me, there's a couple of things. Number one, so I was a product of the BFA and MFA programs, Bachelor of Fine Arts and Master of Fine Arts at UNC Wilmington. And it was a great and supportive program for me. I had a really positive experience. You would think that me being a war veteran and them being, you know, what we consider the hippie creative writing professors, we all get along great. They've all been very supportive of my work. And it's a functioning community that I'm a part of. That being said, the workshop left a little bit to be desired, where here I am at 34 taking classes with 22, 23-year-old kids, again, who are smart and really trying to figure out the world, but they just, you know, I want to write about my life as a warfighter, and part of the model is the workshop model, where we're all giving each other feedback on our work and trying to strengthen it. But they don't have
they don't have the experience, really.
They don't have the experience, and it's not even their fault. I mean,
yeah.
You know, we do what we do so that they don't have. Yeah, and we do what we do so that they don't have to do that kind of stuff. But from the writing perspective, it gets a little hinders you a little bit as a creative type, because you're not getting the feedback you need. So my initial goal was just to be able to provide a space for veterans to come and write the things that they want to, no holds barred, no punches pulled. In fact, one of the things I talk about is write bravely. You know, the quote on there is, it was never safe to write those stories, but you must. And that's from Tim O'Brien. Well, he said that to me, more or less. It's like an approximation of it. But I had put off reading the things that he had carried for a few years because I didn't want anybody to be like, oh, you read it, and so you just copied him. So I wrote the bulk of my work and really honed my craft and my style to make it my own before I even bothered to open his book. But he came to speak at our university, and this was literally after I had just read his book, and I made the mistake of reading it in public on a plane to go see my kid graduate from a Young Marines boot camp. Young Marines is a ROTC program that when the Korean War era Marines thought the Boy Scouts weren't hard enough, so they decided to create a baby Marine Corps, more or less. Yeah, I know. And so my kid joined that, and I went to go see him graduate. And I'm like, oh, I got time. Let me read this book. Like, I wept and I laughed in public on the planes in the thing, the waiting areas, you know.
It's an incredible book.
So, yeah, it really is. And I was kicking myself for not having read it sooner. And I asked him, but one of the things that was so important to me was the emotional content of it. It wasn't just, I got on a plane, I shot some dude in the face, and it was really hard, but it was kind of cool. And then I came home, and now I'm back, and that's kind of hard. The end. Like, he's actually a craftsman. And I was like, how did you, but he's being honest and he's being emotional and truthful. And I asked him, I was like, you know, how did you decide it was safe? And it took me a while to get that question out. And he just kind of chuckled a little bit. He's like, you know, it was never really safe to write those stories. Like, but you must, you owe it to those guys that you served with. I owed it to the guys I served with that we have to write those stories, and you have to be vulnerable. And so I want to be able to give that to those veterans that are taking that class. It's a little hard to be vulnerable though when you don't have people that have nothing in common, and you know the usual standard line is, I could never do what you did, or oh, you must feel so bad for what you did.
Mm-hmm.
And that shuts a lot of veterans down. Used to piss me off something awful. It still kind of does, but I've learned to work through that. And you know, a lot of these guys are getting out broken, and I mean physically broken, like, you know, knees and backs, and they're just tired and they want some place to be like, hey, you're fine, I'll write it out and let's give it some shape and do something with it.
Right.
So that's one of the reasons why that's what really, like, my course philosophy is, we're here to make art of war. And then looking at history, you think about the warrior culture and the creative culture have been intertwined from probably almost the beginning of our history. Because what did we do? Well, when we were gathered around fires, living in caves, the men folk that were able crept across the valley and raided the other folks across that were living in their cave and did what needed to be done to take the supplies and whatever and bring them back to our cave so that we could survive the winter. And then what did we do? Well, we told those stories, and then everybody listened to the stories and experienced the bounty of the war party coming back. And it's like, okay, so now we're a group. Like, we went and did this thing. We all get to survive another winter. You saw the dances. You heard the stories. You know, so we get to survive. And go ahead.
No. Just to kind of expand on that, it obviously starts since the beginning of time, and the most relevant the most relevant ones recently are the World Wars, Vietnam, and then even the current era. And you mentioned the things they carry. What made you choose all the other ones that are on the required text? And can you actually kind of talk about maybe each one specifically and maybe why you chose them? Or
yeah, I can do that. It was really hard to whittle this down. I mean, again, we're looking
at... Yeah, there's a
lot. You can tell by looking at it that it was really hard.
Yeah.
Like, somebody even was like, why'd you leave the Iliad off? I'm like, well, because there's 15 different translations and I only have one semester.
Yeah.
I could teach a whole class just on the Iliad. I could teach a whole class on just the Odyssey. So I chose them. I'm going to just take them. I don't know if you have them in front of me. I just put them alphabetically. So The War Makes Everyone Lonely. Graham, I've read a lot of his poems in literary magazines. In fact, my colleague Melissa Crow was like, oh, by the way, we worked together for like 3 years. Have you ever heard of this veteran writer named Graham Barnhart? She's like, I don't know why I forgot to tell you that. And his poems are really good. I met him. He's a solid dude. He was in 18 Delta, went to Afghanistan once or twice, I think. And his poems are good. And I really liked them. And that's something that it's the most recent book of poetry that I could find for these guys that fits the mold that I wanted to do. The Tale of Soldiers and Civilians and Other Stories by Ambrose Bierce. So Ambrose Bierce is a weird cat, man. Like, he's a cranky old vet. Like, and then he went out and decided at the end of his life he was going to go party with Pancho Villa and then disappeared. That's part of it. He's an intriguing character. Also, his stories are really intriguing. I don't know if you've read that book, but, like, they're not just war stories. Even his war stories, quote unquote, aren't war stories. And that's really what I chose these for. It's like, yes, they're war stories, but there's something going on that can relate to the entire human condition beyond that. That was the overarching theme for the things I've chosen.
I think he's so relevant to like the modern era as well too. Like, when you think about it, if you can place him right in the 21st century, where, you know, where our, you know, our generation like go and fight and then come home and they're all pissy, and then they go like continue to try to touch the dragon like while contracting and stuff like that. Like, just like you said, like he went off with Pancho Villa. Like, you know, there's lots of parallels.
Yeah, and he did not have a good attitude. He was
he was
a character, man, and his stories they're brilliantly crafted. Like, he was writing from a place of experience, so he'd been over those battlefields. He was I can't remember what type of officer he was, which I should know considering I'm teaching him, but I've got a couple of weeks to remember. It'll be fine. But you know, he was an officer, and so he had been at a lot of major battles, and he had seen the Civil War stripped down to its carnage. I think about the first story. Actually, let me just go walk up there and grab it. The first story in the collection that I've in my version is A Horseman in the Sky, right? And it's about an old Southern man and his young Southern son, and the young Southern son feels that he should be a patriot and not a Confederate. And he runs off. Well, actually, he doesn't say that. He leaves it. He's like, I'm going to go off and join the war. And the father says, maybe you shouldn't do that. And he's like, well, I'm going to do my duty. And the father says, well, I'll do mine. I don't want to spoil the story, but the story opens with a young scout seeing an older man on a horse. And he shoots the old man on the horse. Well, do the math. Who do you think it is?
Yeah.
And it's really interesting. So, like, he pulls zero punches. But his stories are mysterious and just so well-crafted and meticulous down at the sentence level. And the other thing I noticed, too, is he writes a lot about – he was a northerner, but he wrote a lot about – or he wrote a fair amount from the perspective of the southerners.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really interesting. We don't get a lot of that. You know, one of the things I didn't want to do is – and. Oh, I'll just pay for it. I'm not reading Navy SEAL books, right? Not reading America books. There's an audience for them. I own several of them. They're not bad, but they're not what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And Ambrose Bierce I think you hit it right on the head. Like, he's a good modern parallel. I chose the companion piece to that, The Red Badge of Courage, because Stephen Crane was born in 1871. So 6 years after the Civil War was ended, he was born. And then he wrote in the 1890s, he wrote The Red Badge of Courage, which was also a great war book. I heard apocryphally that he had just listened to a bunch of old footballers talking, and he kind of got some of it. But the real truth is that he went and he interviewed a lot of old Civil War vets. You know, there was plenty of them still alive. Plenty of them were still ready to talk. And so he went and interviewed them all and crafted The Red Badge of Courage. And I've read The Red Badge of Courage two or three times. And one of the things I've always thought was really fascinating about The Red Badge of Courage, and my complaint about a lot of war writing, even the modern stuff, is nobody ever talks about the boredom. You know, like 98% of your time is just sitting on your ass, sitting on your gear, sweating. Throwing rocks at each other.
The time filler.
At each other.
Jerking off in porta potties.
All of that stuff, nobody talks about that stuff.
That's or at least don't make it the stuff. Yeah, don't make it the focus.
And so that's one of the things I noticed about Stephen Crane's book, is he actually focused a lot on the boredom and the we're just marching and we're just marching and why the hell are we marching? Where are we marching to? back in the days before they had trucks, I guess. that never show up. So I'm going to offend all kinds of people. That's all right. It's fine.
It's all good. that's what we'll go on.
And so, like, that's what, so I chose those two books specifically because I, if any of my students are listening, then they have a heads up now. They're one of the essays in the class is that who did it better and did Stephen Crane have the right to tell those stories?
Yeah.
Because I think that's something that the, it's really interesting how much some of us try to distance ourselves from our military life. As we try to put as much distance between that and our current life as much distance as through it as we possibly can. And we can never get away with it. When we're serving on active duty, the military is the exact representation of the population and cross-section of America. You've got everybody in a platoon or on a ship from all walks of life, from foreign, like everybody, right? In these tight little spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And we are the ones that and the veteran community and the writing community is going through kind of the same thing. Like, you know, everybody's here and the writing community at large is going through this. Well, there's a lot of struggles with, you can't write that. Well, you're stealing from someone's tradition. And we're becoming lazy as readers and as writers. And one of the things that writers have always been able to do is imagine themselves in somebody else's shoes as a form of empathy. Not as exploitation, but empathy.
Yeah.
Right. And we're getting to the point in the culture where nobody wants to imagine themselves in somebody else's shoes. And that's a really dangerous place to be.
Well, it kind of compares a little to, like, let's say you're with those 22, 23 year olds and they just try to do it and they're creative about it. You can appreciate it in its own way. But if they went out and did the legwork of actually interviewing and kind of almost investigating for the truth and actually gathering stories, then they can really put themselves in those places just that much more and actually understand the jargon and understand the mindset and all that. But if they're just trying to do it from without any kind of data collected, then yeah, it's not going to be nearly as respected. But if he did the legwork, then I would imagine it's going to make sense and relate, you know?
Yeah. It really will. And so that's part of the reasons why we chose that. I chose Death Letter because, well, John Daly's John. Yes. I thought it was a really cool fucking essay. So it's funny, but John and I were classmates. And then and he just graduated, and I've been lecturing at UNC Wilmington for like 2 years. So we were like classmates for a year. I don't know if he told you about this, but we actually sat in on a class where the class was reading Phil Clay's Redeployment. And it was really interesting. That's part of the reason, one of the other reasons why I wanted it. I'll go back. Remind me to circle around if I forget, but that's one of the other reasons why I wanted to have open the class up to civilians. That's also, if you'll notice, I'm not reading that book. Let's see. In Our Time by Ernest Hemingway. In Our Time, I chose that one because everybody reaches for The Sun Also Rises. They reach for Whom the Bell Tolls.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah.
Those are the classics, right? Old Man in the Sea is when Hemingway became a caricature of Hemingway. It's not personally my favorite of his. But In Our Time was written in 1923. And so it was his first book. It was before Hemingway was Hemingway. And it was fresh. It was 5 years after the battlefield for him. And so he does a lot of writing about, he does little vignettes, and it's about Nick Adams, who grows up, he goes to Indian, he's, the first story is Indian Country, in the 1923 version. The older version, on the quay at Smyrna is the first vignette. But Nick Adams is a little boy, he goes to watch his dad deliver a C-section, and then Hemingway does this really cool artistic thing where the vignettes become Nick Adams, and the short stories are about other people. And then right around the middle of the book, the vignettes and the short stories become the same. And then they move forward in time. There's a short story about Sergeant Krebs, and Sergeant Krebs, one of the lines in that one is, it's called Soldier's Home. It's like, nobody cared because he'd gotten home after all the parties.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, for those of us that are still at war, when I got out, like, in 2003, when everybody came home from Iraq, it was like, oh, yay, parties. And then that was the end of it. We all went back to the mall. And we all went back to Starbucks. Well, the rest of us went back to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so Hemingway, he addresses that and does it in a really interesting way. And then Big Hearted River 1 and 2, where everybody says, a lot of the criticism on Two Hearted River, parts 1 and 2, or the Big Hearted River, it's where Nick Adams recovers from being wounded and then goes back to his home country, and it had been burned down. And a lot of the criticism is, and I'd written a paper about it, I never got it published, I probably should have, but a lot of the criticism points to these two books is why this was why Hemingway was always going to kill himself. And it's funny, but I had read that as a military veteran, as a war vet, and I was like, well, this is him trying to say that there's hope, actually. And so I, you know, here's this 34-year-old guy with very little college education, but a lot of reading. At the time, I was an undergraduate on the road. He's like, yeah, you're all wrong. Like, Hemingway thought that there was hope. Like, Hemingway felt that nature would come back. He knew that he had to go fish the fish in the area that he didn't want to. He knew he was going to have to. And you see this really great struggle. And so it's him struggling, his character, Nick Adams being a thinly veiled version of himself, struggling with what we would call PTSD now, and really trying to win out and at least addressing that in a way that wasn't the victim. It wasn't the victim, and he wasn't, you know, standing on a pile of dead German corpses beaten on his chest. He was just a regular dude like us. So that's why I chose that one. War Horses by Yusef Komunyakaa. So he's a Pulitzer Prize winning poet. And he's brilliant. He's a Vietnam veteran. One of my students, Alexis Olson, we just call her Al. She's like, have you ever heard of this? It's funny, but everybody in the creative writing department knows about all these people. And it's like, oh, I forgot that you were, I mean, you're a veteran. And it just occurred to me that this writer is a veteran and you should read him. It's happened a dozen times, and he's brilliant. And War Horses is great because it's fairly modern. I think he came out in 2000, in the middle 2000s, I think. I mean, I guess I could just not be lazy and go look at, see when it came out. I want to say 2011. And what's interesting about this is earlier at the beginning of the podcast, I talked about how this all goes back to history, right? 2008. So the Warrior and the Creative go all the way back to the founding of history. Well, War Horses starts off in Nebuchadnezzar's palace, and he goes through the generations of warfighters to the Twin Towers and beyond. And I just think that's a really cool craft conceit that you write a book of poems that are linked from through warfare from the beginning of history to now. So just some food for thought for the guys and the women in my class to read. Like, this is another way to solve problems. One of the things I tell my students is writing is problem solving. What story are you going to tell, and then how do you tell it? So I'm just giving options, basically.
Yeah. It's incredibly diverse, and you've obviously done your research trying to find each one and how they will play into this overall scheme, where they add value to one another, but they're completely different in their own way.
Yeah, they are. They had the things they carried because, well, that book means a lot to me. One of my favorite stories in that is How to Tell a True War Story. One of my favorite lessons about that is I teach the civilians. That also the civilian students, when I'm teaching the rest of the population, I use that story. Like, that's an allegory, right? You've got that really harrowing scene where Rat Kiley is shooting up a little water buffalo, and the platoon starts shooting up a water buffalo, and usually without fail, the civilian kids are like, well, why is he shooting the water buffalo? And I'm like, well, do you realize that these kids that he's writing about are your age? And they're like, oh, well, no, I hadn't. Did you care about them? No, but you cared about this water buffalo. Why? Because it's the baby. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So these kids are in the infantry, and they're killing a water buffalo. And you look at where he shoots it. He shoots it in the knee. Well, they're grunts. They're called legs. They're carrying. He's like, I'm like, most of, you ask any infantryman, and they'll tell you that their knees are gone. Those are lower back. Maybe their shoulders too. Mm. I was like, he shoots it in the mouth. What happens if you shoot it in the mouth? Well, then it can't talk anymore. Well, these kids don't know how to express that Kurt Lemon just got blown up, and they don't know how to express that. So you don't, he doesn't know how to express it. You don't know how to understand that. But if he has a character shoot a water buffalo in the mouth, then you understand that the water buffalo can't cry. So these kids can't cry either, that they can't cry out. Right. So the things they carry, that's, I mean, it's just it's such an amazing book for those reasons.
I say you're teaching me some stuff right now.
Yeah.
I guess that's good, right?
Yeah, well, so you're just going to be dropping knowledge bombs the whole time.
I try. I don't want to waste anybody's time, you know?
Yeah.
So I chose the things they carried because, again, that's one of the things where the war is background noise, and the book itself is about the human condition. Mm-hmm. It's about how do warfighters communicate with one another, and then how do they communicate outside, right? Because Norman Bowker and some of the other guys, they survive Vietnam and they go out into the civilian world, and Tim O'Brien's character even moves forward in time to when he has a daughter and a family and goes back to Vietnam. And I think it's a really well-crafted book, and the way he plays with time and vision perspective. The short story, the name of it escapes me, where he talks about the one person he killed. Okay, I really didn't kill him. But I mean, I kind of did because it was my grenade. But, like, you know, and he plays with vision and expectation and reality. I think, again, that's the things I've chosen are, how do we tell our stories without, I mean, it's 2019 at this point. There's been a billion movies. There's been a billion war stories. And it's important that we tell those stories in the ways that we can, but when we want to start looking at making an impact and making our countrymen understand, I don't have to be gruesome and bloody anymore. They could go watch that. They could go watch 13 Hours. They could go watch the Fell Down the Mountain movie. Lone Survivor, right?
Like, Fell Down the Mountain movie. Speaking of that, are you going to include anything regarding film or anything like that?
I think that's probably another course.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, but I wasn't sure.
It depends. So the way the course is now, like, I've got my setup Being a military guy, I'm super flexible. Like, right, the first law of warfare is chaos, and chaos causes communication breakdown. And I might get into the class, and the class, like, they might need something differently. I just might sense that, and we might look at a movie. I've got some flex time where we can look at that. Because honestly, that's one of the questions that, like, civilians that I've become friends with, or my friends, well, like, what do you think of war? Like, we know what you think of war books. What war movies are, like, in your top, right? And why are these movies better than other movies? I think that's something that, if I don't do it in this course, it'll probably be another course. Mm-hmm. I've got also All Quiet on the Western Front, because I cracked up. I read it a few years ago for, like, the second or third time. It's, like, the greatest war novel of all time.
Yeah. I read that when I was really, really young.
And it's like, okay, cool, why? But some of the reasons why it's the greatest war novel of all time is they're not in the trenches all that. Well, they're in the trenches a lot, but, like, I remember the scenes of them stealing a pig because they were so hungry, so they killed it, and then getting shit. I've never read I can't think of any book that I've read in a long time about warfare that brought up somebody having the shits because your stomach can't handle it. But, like, that's a fact of our life. Like, our stomachs are jacked up forever. Like, and so them having to go get chocolate to stop them up, and how they had the NCO leading, and then they had the fucking chicken shit NCO that was always just riding their asses about discipline and uniforms, and he was just a jerk because he was an admin guy who'd been put in charge, Corporal Himmelstoss, mm-hmm. right? And you've got this tension, and then the reality and the lack of hope, even on the German side. And I chose it because it was from the German side, not the American side.
Yeah.
Bloods I chose because Wallace Terry is a journalist who wrote about the Black experience in Vietnam. So he interviewed many, many soldiers in Vietnam and then put together an oral history. So again, giving my students options, like, maybe you're not a poet, maybe you're not a fiction writer, but you want to do something. Here's how you can get involved, and here's how you do it. And I've got civilians that are taking this class too.
Yeah, you said that. We were talking the other day about, you know, you said you had a certain number of veterans, couple spouses. How is that working? Like, are you having people kind of do intros, like, on a Blackboard format or something like that?
No, I'm gonna take advantage of the fact that this is a room full of vets, and I'm gonna make them talk. Nice. Most of the vets I get complain about how college isn't this or the other. Cool. Well, now you're coming into my classroom, and I run it just like I would run my own platoon. I expect you to speak. I expect you to engage. But also, I'm giving them an essay where, like, I want to know them first. And then, so this course isn't just a reading course. Like, they're turning in workshop pieces. So we're going to be continually looking at each other's work throughout mm-hmm. the course of the semester. So they'll get to know each other. This is going to be a discussion-based question, or a discussion-based class, sorry. And so I expect all my students that have taken my classes know that there is no escaping. They will speak at least once or twice during the semester. Their grades depend on it, and I expect them to say something smart. So I'll set these ground rules that, like, I expect you to, like, at the beginning, as we get to know each other, remind us of your background, why you have the perspective that you have, and learn to defend your perspective. Your perspective isn't wrong, but I want to know.
And that's what writing gives you, is opportunity to do it and perfect it. Like you said, it solves the problems, and it's an ongoing process. You write once, you rewrite, and you revisit, and sometimes you're more emotional at other times, sometimes you're a little bit more logical, and so you're able to kind of just differentiate between those two types of thinking, come up with a clear way of thinking and understanding and viewing this world.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the last book that's on that list, and these are not in chronological order, Slaughterhouse-Five, Kurt Vonnegut. Mm.
He's becoming one of my favorite authors recently.
He's brilliant. I also really like Player Piano. Player Piano is cool if you haven't read it, because it's about a society that depends on technology.
Mm-hmm.
And then they rebel against the technology, and then they go right back into the technology right after the rebellion.
Of course. I just recently read Sirens of Titan, and I'm currently reading Cat's Cradle. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah, he's amazing. And when I read Slaughterhouse-5, it was probably one of the fastest I've ever read a book. It's just so quick, so simple. So many intertwining storylines and thoughts. It's just, he's awesome. But I want to hear your thoughts on it, because I'm sure you've looked into it more than I have.
Well, the reason I chose Slaughterhouse-5 is, I mean, it's basically, it's a war story. Mm-hmm. Everybody always talks about how it's satire and it's humor and it is dealing with trauma, but it's about his experiences in the war. Kurt Vonnegut was I'm pretty sure was in Dresden during the firebombing.
Mm-hmm.
This is another semi-autobiographical piece, right? And so you see, and I love that the guy Billy Pilgrim is not a war hero.
Mm-hmm.
He's a regular dude. What happens to the war hero guys, the tough guys? They end up dead. And the soft, normal guy who just bounced around to get through made it through, but he still saw some horrible things.
Yeah.
It's interesting because in the culture that we've got now, it's like it's all about the tip of the spear and the operator and the cool beards and the cool gear. And it's like, bro, we used to be guys that just did our job.
Yep.
Quietly.
Mm. Well, then
go home.
And the percentage of the ratio of those guys and just the regular guys, it's by and large just regular guys.
Yeah. And so that's the first thing that I love about that is that it's just the regular guy. He's kind of the born loser character. But he's trying to move forward after the war. And it's not even that he was trying to move forward. It's not like they came home like, oh, you've been through this traumatic thing. Like, what can we do for you? It's like, all right, hey, thanks for killing fascism. So now you need to go get a job and you need to start a family. Like there were things that you had to do to come back. There was expectations.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't stop because you fought a war. Like you had to come back and give to the society. But he was still struggling with some stuff, which is why he comes unstuck in time, right? And
I love that sci-fi aspect to it.
Yeah, and so the sci-fi is great, and that kind of ties in a little bit too with the horror and Ambrose Bierce a little bit. But what I love about Lost in Sci-Fi is you think about the most military veterans that served, whether they were men or women or whatever. Time is a big problem for us because our past is our past, but it's also our present. And it's also going to be the future. And so you look at the little alien people that look at the spectrum of time as a ribbon and they can see the past, the present, and the future all at once.
Yep.
Well, in my experience and speaking in my own life and then speaking with other veterans, we're living the past and the present and the future all at once. I play around with time in my own work. People like, well, when you talk about your past tense experiences, you write them in the present tense. I'm like, yeah, because sometimes those memories are like, right now.
Yep.
And it doesn't mean I'm crazy and it doesn't mean I'm broken. It just means that my past is my present. Mm-hmm. It just happens to be. And I've learned to move between those two. And I know that in the future, that's going to still happen. Maybe not as frequently. And it doesn't happen frequently now because, I've been out a long time, but that's just, time is really fluid for us. And so I think that Kurt Vonnegut, other than just being a really amazing storyteller, I think that's useful for veterans to see that you can take all of these threads and make a cohesive narrative. Like the idea of the aliens seeing time in a way that it's all finished and the beginning and the middle and the end, well, that's how we live. And the bird saying pooty wheat, right? Like, yep. And so it goes. Like, it's just, it is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we live in a time where we fetishize the victim and it's like, it's not what it is. I mean, there's got to be, it is what it is.
He's,
or so it goes.
He's
right?
So, yep. He's,
yeah.
It was just brilliant.
Yeah. One of the things I love about Kurt Vonnegut is his, there's a YouTube video of him talking about the shape of stories. And the typical answer for the shape of story is what's called the Freytag pyramid, right? You've got your rising action, it's the sharp edge of the pyramid. You've got your climax, which is the pinnacle of the pyramid. And then you got your denouement, which is just the drop off. And that can be steep or graded, but it's a triangle.
Mm-hmm.
He was a dramatist. He was not a storyteller by trade, Freytag was. And Kurt Vonnegut goes in there, and most people teach that this is the way a story should be shaped. You use a Freytag pyramid. And Kurt Vonnegut's like, stories come in all kinds of shapes. I don't give a shit what shape you use. Stories come in shapes. Like, you make the shape for your story. And so he was kind of an iconoclast in that way. Which again, you know, like Ambrose Bierce, and even Stephen Crane a little bit was like that. Ernest Hemingway was definitely like that. So like some of these guys are a little rough around the edges, and that's part of why I chose them too. Cause I mean, they're just, they're cool writers, and they'd been a good group of people to knock a beer or two back with.
Absolutely.
So
that's the reading list.
So that's the reading list.
And then you're going to have like other, you're going to have other articles, essays, things like that posted to the.
So like I've got two, there was one and there's other ones that are going to come up. But like one of the ones that I've got on there is, it came out in Harper's in 2015 by a guy named Sam Sachs. It's called First Person Shooter. And he basically says that veteran writing isn't as good as it once was. And it wasn't as good as Tim O'Brien's. And I wonder why. And he goes on to say that it's because there isn't a political statement. And I disagree with him on that point. I don't think he realizes that we don't think in terms of politics because we don't have that right. The political comes after, not during, but the way that most modern veteran writers write, they're writing about the present. So they wouldn't have that their political idea. And really what he meant was, he wanted their political ideas to match his own, and they don't, and that's why it doesn't work. But I do think that veteran writing isn't as powerful in a lot of ways and using Tim O'Brien's, the things they carried, which is one of the ones he does, is one of those reasons. And you look at the emotional content, we're really concerned with giving the action, but not the emotion and the relationship between them. And then the other article that we're looking at was just showed up on Plowshares, and it's about the dirty realism and contemporary war literature, and why the right author of this, I can't remember who it is, postulates that, and he's a veteran, he's a Marine Corps veteran. I think he's running for office in Iowa or Indiana, one of the I states, that we're just giving our audience what we want. Our audience is conditioned for dirty realism, and that's why modern war literature is glorying in that. And John Daly and I both talked about this article, and we disagree with it. That the example he used is really old, and John and I both want more out of writing because we're capable of giving more. We're capable of critical thought.
For sure.
And just saying, oh, well, it was about shooting the camel and all of this, all of the action, that's what people want to read. Well, just because that's what they want to read, that doesn't mean that's what they want to hear. And it doesn't mean that's what they need to hear.
Yeah.
We have stuff to say, and I think that it needs to be said. And I think that our countrymen need to listen. And just giving them the glory moment that they want, basically, it's a bunch of war porn addicts. Is what we're raising by the kinds of stories. Like they want they'll click through all the little YouTube videos, but they don't want to take a pack and a rifle. You know, they don't want to hear the moral dilemma of, do I frag this house or not? What do we do? We're taking fire from this mosque. They want to just see the cool stuff and read about how cool it was. They don't want to be bothered with. And it's not even that they don't want to be bothered, but they don't know that they need to know those things. Those things come with a cost. Not that we're being victimized. We volunteered.
Mm-hmm.
We knew the cost. Even if we didn't know the cost, we probably knew the cost.
Well, then, and like you said, we were young, and now we're trying to we're trying to figure out how we make sense of all of it too. And one of the ways I've always explained it is we had this limited worldview, and war in itself just pretty much opened up the spectrum of human capacity, both on the good and evil. And so we saw the insides of both those spectrums at such an early age. And the only way to really kind of sort through them is by talking them out, reading about them, writing them.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we've always tried to do here with the Dead Reckoning is bridging that gap between the veterans and civilians, because here in a civilized society, they're just not necessarily exposed to those spectrums. And right. So they can relate to them and their own personal experience with life and death and love and hate and everything. But we have to be able to tell them how we experience those at the far extreme, you know?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think that that's, there was a moment in time a couple of years ago where I ran into that and really started that. Again, this is why I love the creative writing department. I wrote an essay that was selected for Best American. It's in fourth genre. It's a long list of all the things you can't don't talk about. Oh, wait, no, that's not that essay. I wrote a different essay. Well, I wrote that one too. But I wrote another essay called Sleep, and this is where it came out. This came up in class. So I wrote this essay called Sleep because I always thought it was really weird. I could sleep through an artillery barrage or cruise missiles. I could sleep through air and artillery like a motherfucker. If it wasn't coming at me, I slept soundly.
Yeah.
I get back home. I've got my bed. I've got my shower. I've got my slippers. Can't sleep a wink. Why? So I started writing this essay, and the way I do it is it's impressionist. It's all the times in country where I could sleep, and all the times in back home when I could not, and allowing my reader to see these different things and making sense of it what they will. That's my aesthetic. And one of the scenes that I write is about how when I'm coming home from ship and I was on the bottom coffin rack, and every once in a while, more often than not, one of my Marines would come back and be like, hey, are you asleep? And of course I was asleep. And they're like, or do you want to go get midrats? And no, I wanted to sleep, but like my guys needed me. So I got up and we would go walk the ship and they would talk about some of the things they saw and some of the nightmares they would have. Well, my department chair was at the time just was teaching the class. And he's like, you know what's really weird? He's like, I don't know anything about the stuff that you're writing about. He's like, but I understand about the nightmares coming in. He's like, I understand about the darkness coming at night. He's like, I was in a horrible car accident and I have nightmares at night. Isn't that weird? And so we were able to relate over the human condition and our shared experiences. And I think that it's great that there's an organization like yours that's actually out there committed to bridging those gaps. I think it's about time. You know, we've been, the war's supposedly ended within the last few years a couple of different times now, but those types of, yeah, supposedly. Right. I know. Supposedly. Yeah. And that's a whole nother discussion on its own, but, but yeah, so like that's, I want to give my students the tools to do that with their countrymen. And it's great to have civilian kids and civilian men and women and dependents or military affiliated folks, I guess is the proper term to call them now. In the room together.
Absolutely.
Right.
With our rules. Because one of the things is, you know, I would walk into a creative writing classroom and it's on their terms, for lack of a better term.
And you get to set the stage now.
And I can like, this is the way it's in my syllabus. I talk about it. It's like, you know, you're going to read some stuff you don't agree with that you might cause problems for you. And I'm sorry, but you don't get out of it. There's no, you will look and you will engage. There's no other option to get a grade around it. You don't get to shrink away from it.
Well, man, so, I'm excited for you. I think this is going to help a lot of people, and this is only the beginning, so that's what's even cooler, is just hearing the passion that you have for it and just how excited you are. That's just going to translate and to all your students, I think, at least, or I hope.
I hope so, too. I hope it's a really good course. I'm glad that you guys are excited about it. I'm glad other people are getting excited about it. I think it's time, and I'm not the only one. I'm sure there's other people that are doing the same thing. And I think it's great that we're all probably working in our own little areas, and eventually we'll all be able to come together and start doing something pretty cool. So
definitely. Yeah. Well, let's wrap it up, with that, because, I think we're definitely going to have you on again. Either as the course progresses or after the course, to kind of, because you kind of laid out, you know, the how you formed the course and the syllabus and all that, and I would really, really like to hear your opinions on how it goes after. We're really, really excited.
Is there anything that you maybe is there anything that maybe you want to plug or share with anybody that you don't think maybe you got the chance to yet?
I think I did. I think I got everything.
Good. Yeah.
Is there any place people can find you on social media? Are you posting anything about the course?
The only thing I posted the other day was just my reading list. I didn't realize it was going to have that big of an impact. at RP_BealsWrites on Instagram. That's usually where I go. People can find me on Instagram at RP_BealsWrites.
I guess just real quickly, what are your goals as a writer? Real quick, you can answer that just real fast.
My goals as a writer are to continue to refine my craft.
Yeah.
I'd love to get my manuscript published. It's at some publishers now, and hopefully someone will see literary merit in it. And then I've got other projects I want to get done. You know, my family, it's really funny, but my last name is Ramos, and our family name is Duarte, and we settled the California area. There's a city named after us and a statue of my great-great ancestor. Well, I can track my family all the way back to 1756, and all of the men in my family were soldiers.
Right on.
Every one of them during that time frame. They came over from Spain as soldiers and then moved to Mexico and then moved into Alta California. And so I want to tell that story. I mean, there's a whole world that I want to write about. So, I don't know that I really answered that question.
Yeah, no, that's it. That's good enough right there. I'm just curious. But no, man, again, yeah, it was great having you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we'll look forward to having you on again.
I think the biggest misperception is that somehow we're damning. But nothing really can stop us.